Well, hello, everyone. It is great to be back. And today I get a chance to talk with somebody who I'm excited to talk to because we met in Tokyo and then he was telling me about his book. I picked up his book and I loved it. So, Lou, good morning to you over in Tokyo.
Good morning. Here, Tokyo time. All right. Thank you, Tommy, for having
now,
me on
Lou,
the podcast.
We're going to talk about a whole bunch of different things. We're going to talk about your book. We're going to talk about your journey. We're going to talk about life lessons, all of that stuff. But before we do, for those who may not be familiar, talk about life in Tokyo. What does life in Tokyo mean to you? Because you've lived there for a number of years.
Life in Tokyo is great. You know, Tokyo, I'm not sure, you know, just, you know, in case some of the listeners haven't been to Tokyo before, is the capital of Japan. So Japan is, I would say, a sizable country, 120 million people. Yeah. And one out of three people in Japan lived around Tokyo. So Tokyo, is a big capital city, has about 40 million people living around the Tokyo, greater Tokyo area. It's a cosmopolitan city, you know, comfortable life, very safe. So ladies, you can walk around at night, you know, in pretty much any neighborhood. There's no certain neighborhood is more dangerous than the other. I mean the food restaurant tech business. I would say Tokyo is the best foodie city in the world. Right.
Oh, so even the 7-Eleven is really good, Lou.
Exactly. Exactly. So the number of Michelin restaurants, star restaurants in Tokyo is always number one. I don't know for how many years it's always number one by default. More than 300 Michelin star restaurants, and the restaurant number of restaurants in total, there are 160,000 restaurants just in this one city. Is the city has the most number of restaurants in the world, right? So. Yeah. And with the dropping, like, you know, yen compared to U.S. dollars, you know, the most currencies in the world, Tokyo is becoming rather reasonable and to some, to maybe Americans, maybe cheap. Yeah. Having a ramen, like the top of the world ramen, only costs less than $10. There's no ramen that costs more than $10 usually.
Yeah.
So with the quality and with the price, with the, you know, I love city Tokyo. That's where my wife was born, and for the foreseeable future, I think we're gonna live in Tokyo.
Yeah, very, very good. Look, how long have you lived in Tokyo for?
All right, this time, 10 years is my good. 10 years. Well, the reason I say this time is because I first came to Japan 31 years ago in 1993, and I lived in Tokyo for, you know, or the greater Tokyo area for around 10 years and then left. So this is my second time. And altogether, I spent 20 years in Japan, in Tokyo. Yes.
Yeah. And for those who are listening, Lou, I love what you're doing with your job, your startup and all that stuff. How would you describe what you do for a living and what your company does?
Okay, very simple. So as I said, Tokyo is amazing. It's the best foodie city in the world. But for foreigners, they come to Japan, they have no idea where these great restaurants are. And the language is a barrier. They know most people in the world, they don't speak Japanese. And what I'm doing is we're connecting the best restaurants in Japan with foreign tourists to help them find, reserve, order, and pay, and have a great experience in Japan. So that's my app. It's called Take Me. So take me to the best restaurants in Tokyo, in Tokyo, not only Tokyo, limited, Kyoto, Osaka, you know, all around Japan.
Yeah, so it's called Take Me. And one question, and I would love to dive into your book. Like when you started Take Me, what made you decide to do it? Walk me through a process. Did you just sit there one day and say, wow, we need an app like this? Or did someone give you that idea? How did the idea start? Yeah.
It's just very natural because since I have been to a lot of, you know, living in China, U.S., so I have a lot of friends all around the world, right? And once I moved back to Tokyo in 2014, I have friends coming to Tokyo all the time, like in the peak season, say Sakura season next month, right? you know, almost every week I have friends, you know, emailing me, texting me, saying, hey, Lou, I'm in Tokyo next week. Where should I eat? Where, come on, come and book this restaurant. Can you book some restaurant for us? And, you know, let's get together. So I'm almost like a host to all my global friends. And they have a universal comment. When I take them to these restaurants, when I book this restaurant, when I go with them, order the food, tell them the stories, right? And they have a universal comment. It's like, Lou, without you, I'm never able to find this restaurant. Or I'll never get to know this detail of the craftsmanship, the food. I'll never have the same experience without your help. So I'm like, I'm not even a foodie compared to a lot of, you know, the so-called foodies. They spend, you know, one foodie I know is like, he eats at 500 restaurants per year. That means more than one restaurant per day. I'm not even like that, right? So, and I look around on the, I'm a, you know, I would say internet or technology entrepreneur for, you know, before I started, you know, take me, I started two companies before in China. So naturally I just looked for the other solutions, right? So there's pain point and there's solutions. So I found the reason is because there's no such service. You know, this is like back in 10 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago, when I first moved back to Japan, targeted, you know, the foreign tourists in Japan to do these things, to give them a recommendation, to help them reserve restaurants, solve the language, you know, differences, and also have payment involved. So you don't have to look around in Japan in the middle of the night of ATM machine to withdraw cash.
Yeah.
Because Japan is a big cash country, you know, 80% of the retail is done by cash pre-COVID. After COVID, it's 70%. So still, 70% of the retail locations only accept cash, right? So all these problems, I just figure, oh, wow, I have this, you know, moment that there's so much pain, right, in terms of, you know, dining experience every day for every foreigners in Japan, and there's no such solution. Well, someone has to do it, and because, you know, I have my tech background, I'm like, okay, I can easily put together a app or a service to achieve those things.
Good. Very, very good. Wow. Thank you very much for sharing. Now, it looks like a lot of times, even hearing you talk, you've lived in Tokyo multiple times, then you lived in China, then you lived in the U.S. Talk a little bit about your journey, and which leads us into the book that you wrote today. Talk a little bit about all the different places that you've been, and in some sense, what made you move from one place to another to another?
Sure. Which I think, you know, if you give me 5 minutes to describe, this is going to be basically essentially the summary of the book, is how I walked my life journey up until this point. So I was born in Beijing, China. In an academic family, life were, you know, stable for all of us, although we're not very rich in cash. But I would say I grew up in an environment that's really rich in knowledge and values. The turning point for me for my entire family, and also I think for the country, and also that's a very reason for me to leave China and come to Japan, was in 1989, right? Tiananmen. There's a Tiananmen massacre. So the government and the army fired to the students that they were protesting. In not only just in Tiananmen Square, but basically all Beijing. And because I'm a Beijinger, I was 17 at the time. I was not a college student, but because I was living in a college, you know, my grandfather, my father, you know, we were all living in a big university campus. So naturally I was part of the university students. And I was, you know, dodging bullets, burning tents with the college students. And that event basically changed my life, changed, I would say, my family life. And my family decided to leave China. This is pre-internet, right? So, and nobody of my family member ever, I would say, except my grandpa, you know, he studied at Soviet Union. But after that, nobody had ever gone overseas to study. So it took me and also took my family a couple of years to figure out how to get out of China. And eventually I came to Japan by myself in
1993. Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And my dad took a diplomat position. He went to India, then as a diplomat, and also after that, Korea and the U.S. So all my family members basically scattered around in the world. And actually, we never lived together after 1989.
And Luke, did you have siblings as well, too?
Yes, I have a younger sister. She's 3 years younger than me. And she first went to India with my family. Mm-hmm. She actually got into college in India. And then after that, she went to the UK by herself. And then she lived in the UK for more than 20 years. Also an entrepreneur in founded her own company in London. That's our a short story of our family. Now my parents are retired. They live in Beijing right now peacefully. But about on my side, so I came to Japan when I was 20. The living, I would say the income level back then, the average, I would say GDP per capita of China is like about 1/30 of now, right? So I in the book I described, all my family members have to borrow money to gather all the savings. That's still not enough just to pay one term of my tuition in a language school.
Wow.
That was about roughly $4,000. So $4,000 was like, like four times of my family, like my grandma's family, my grandpa's family's entire savings. So we have to borrow a lot of money just to send me here to Japan to study for one quarter and with a one-way ticket to Japan. So I have to figure it out. It's a survival game, right? So I landed in Tokyo with one suitcase, with the bare minimum of Japanese language, which I learned in a couple of months before I came to Japan. And that was it. That was like game start. Within a week, I basically found myself washing dishes in a restaurant and learning language, in the language school in the morning. So working 8 hours a day in a restaurant and spending minimum. So that was, to the 20-year-old, me, I think that was really, really the most difficult experience in my life.
Yeah.
So compared to any of the difficulties, I know startups a lot of difficulties right now, but I would say nothing compared to that 1 year of experience when I just got in Tokyo, right? The loneliness, the physical difficulty. Go ahead.
And no, that was what I was just going to ask you. For you, what part was it? Was it the loneliness? Was it the physical capability, the emotional toll? What was the hardest for you?
Yes, I would say by far the loneliness. The physical difficulty I described in the book is like how much I don't eat, right? So I really need to save money. I only eat once per day, and I was so skinny. I cut my fingers during, in the kitchen. So there are a lot of physical difficulties, but on top of the physical difficulty, I think the hardest thing was the loneliness, the mental. This is pre-internet. Again, pre-internet era, and I have no money to call international phone calls. So, I was only by myself, I had no friends in a foreign country. I don't speak the language. So, third month after I arrived in Japan, which my Japanese still wasn't that great, and also I didn't make any friends, the language school got into 1 month summer holiday. So for the entire month, I didn't speak a word to anyone. So I'm not sure if anyone had this experience. So spending 1 month not talking for a single word.
Wow.
I think at the end of that 1 month that I kind of felt like I was crazy. I was going crazy.
Yeah.
I felt I was a transparent person. I wasn't even sure if I exist or not. Right. So I go on the streets. I purposely like bump into people to make sure when they look at me, someone look at me. And if someone has some reaction about me. So, because I lived in this really tiny apartment. And I wake up, study, go do wash dishes and come back, that cycle. And during the whole process, and because I couldn't people also have the impression that I don't speak the language. So I just don't speak at all. And and also, I was only 20 years old, right? I was thinking about my family in China. I don't want to disappoint them. You know, it's just a really, really lonely experience. And I started talking to the mirror to myself. It's like, if I don't talk, I literally just go crazy. So that's,
Lou, as you look back, here you are a little bit older now, and all these decades have passed.
Yes.
How did it change you? How did it become, you look back at those, they're tough memories. They really changed you. How did that change you as a person?
Very good question. I think it, well, like people said, it builds character, right? It built a lot of endurance, perseverance. It gave me, what didn't kill me, made me stronger. But it also reflect a lot of the values and the format. You know, like when I grew up in China, when I lived with my parents and grandparents as a elementary school student, as a teenager. So all these values kind of condensed, and that becomes stronger during my time when I was in Japan alone by myself. So I was living off these values, I was thinking. So that I don't, you know, I was, there are possibilities, there are opportunities to do these bad things, right? So there are gangsters in Japan. There are, you know, other ways to make money much quicker and easier. And I didn't choose the easier and quicker path to make money. I think a lot of the, facing a lot of choices ahead of me, had a very clear goal ahead of me, and also had a very consistent decision-making process that I don't just always make the easy choices, I make hard choices. I purposely went out to the hard paths that led to me today.
To a great degree, it reminds me, my parents immigrated to the U.S. in 1972. I was born in 1977. And the area that we lived in was mostly a Caucasian area. And my mom had left communist China when it was just becoming communist, all of that stuff. And she was separated from her family, and she came from a wealthy family, and all of it was gone. And we just didn't have any money. For the longest time, Lou, we used to eat ramen noodles, hot dog and lettuce is our meal. And I always wonder why, or did they just like it that much, until I realized we just had no money. But you were picked on by a lot of the Caucasian students because I was Chinese. I was the only Chinese in my neighborhood. So I was different. So they just picked on you. But more so, I think a lot of times I also dealt with my mom's anger, my parents' anger, mostly my mom, who, because of all the stuff that happened to her, I don't think ever really got over it. And we took the brunt of it as kids.
Yes, I understand. I can completely understand. So my on my wife's side, I think her experience is closer to you. So I'm the first generation immigrant, right? And she is the second generation. So her parents moved from China to Japan, and she was born in Japan, but in the Chinese family. So very much like you. And her hearing her stories, that's why we kind of immediately connected when we met, because you know we all have this kind of identity crisis, have all the struggles, right? And yes, definitely.
After Japan, then from that point on, where did you go? The U.S. or Singapore?
U.S. So after living in Japan for 10 years, so I did, you know, fast, you know, forward. I graduated from college. I was fortunate to got into Goldman Sachs in Japan. So life was became dramatically different, but I still have this goal to go to the U.S. To study in the U.S. Right?
So very impressive that you got all the way.
I think this has all come from my grandfather, right? He's a PhD himself. He's like, well, you know, it's like you're smart. It's like at least you should get a master. So it's like never satisfied with just a college degree. He's always encouraging me, even like, you know, when he write me letters from China, he always had this newspaper clips about, you know, the NBA rankings and blah, blah, blah. So I always have this in mind that I got to go to the business school. And of course, in Goldman Sachs, everybody around me had an MBA. So it's very natural for me to just go get an MBA in the US.
George, let me stop you. I mean, not George, Lou, let me stop you right there. I actually had, my family had a relative by the name of George. That's why I just called you George, from Hawaii. Yes. Older gentleman. He used to clip the newspaper articles of college rankings and bicycles and sent it to my mom for us.
Yes. You know, I think that's obviously it's a very, I would say, natural path for me. So I went to the US for 2 years of course, when I was in Goldman, I was on and off, you know, in New York, Wall Street for about 8 months. But you know, in the Silicon Valley, you know, in the middle of Silicon Valley, Stanford Business School really, I would say, changed me or brought the natural me out, right? So the I would say the calling for freedom, right? The calling for creativity. I always felt, I could remember this when I was in high school, I had no idea what work is, what the society is. I always had this feeling, the unknown confidence that I was going to start a company by myself. Yeah. I don't know why. And so I felt that even though, you know, I was in finance, in Wall Street, I felt living like a king, but once I'm in the Silicon Valley and around the, you know, students in Stanford, I just felt, wow, this is home for me.
Yeah.
You know,
I knew
I belong. Yeah. My heart belongs to entrepreneurship and co-creation. And now, you know, after, you know, all this in the book I wrote, that I now understand it's not just me making the decision. It's not me. It's actually God. It's, yeah. You know,
And in some sense,
and give this purpose to me. Yes, go ahead.
And he's leading you on this journey, right? I mean, a lot of times, look at David. A lot of times, he had to spend some time as a shepherd boy. His father, when Samuel called him and said to Jesse, "Do you have any other sons?" "Oh, wait. I have a younger one, David." And so he brings him in, and David had to learn to take care of the sheep. It was monotonous. It was boring. He was by himself. But boy, did God use that time to help him learn how to protect the sheep, learn how to fight lions and bears and all that stuff. So he ends up fighting Goliath. And then from that point, he gets into conflict with Saul. And he ends up by himself for the cave of Adullam. We never know the journey that he has. And for you, is he's brought you from place to place to place, learning how to work washing dishes. But then at the same time, leaving your homeland, being separated from your family, then finding success in Wall Street, realizing, wait, that's not it, but feeling like you're at home at Stanford.
Yes. So, yeah. So naturally after Stanford, it's like, hey, I gotta do some startup, you know, but I have no idea what I'm going to do. But the first thing I thought, you know, since I left China for 12 years and China started looking promising. Right. This is after 2003 SARS, if you remember. SARS, very similar to COVID, right? So preventing people from going out. That's where the internet started to become practical, right? So in 2003, two of the nowadays biggest internet companies started in 2003, Alibaba. And JD. So these are the two biggest e-commerce platforms in China, all started in 2003, because even using 56K dial-up modems, people have to go online to buy things because they cannot go out. So that kickstarted the internet or the e-commerce boom. And I graduated in 2004. So it's like, okay, things are starting in China. And when people say Chinese returnees, haigui, right? Return from US or somewhere, mostly US, you know, from Silicon Valley or Wall Street, back to China, copy the business models that, you know, from the US to China. Because China was behind, right? So that was the era where I saw, wow, I could be doing something similar, right? Because I experienced in, you know, the finance world in Japan and also entrepreneurial technology world in Silicon Valley, Stanford. I could, you know, do something in China. And also one very big, drive for me, a calling for me, even just to go to Stanford, I just want to, you know, just went back a little bit. I all have had this calling that I need to do something for the unprivileged people. You know, even when I was a banker, I was a private banker at Goldman Sachs, serving the most, the wealthiest tycoons in Japan, right? So they are my clients. But I always resonate with the poor people because reminding where I came from, right? I got really shocked, moved by this Muhammad Yunus, who started Grameen Bank, a P2P lending business model to really help the poor people in the poverty, right, in Bangladesh. So $50 could change someone's life. So that was really, really shocking to me. So that watching that documentary, I was like, wow, I what I'm doing, I'm just only here making rich people richer. I don't feel that's a purpose of my life. I want to make an impact to the common people, to the broad, especially the underprivileged people. So I think that's the very strong reason why I went to Stanford, because Stanford was very famous for social entrepreneurship. And I did a lot of projects there. So, and just feel like, okay, although US is very comfortable, I could stay in the Bay Area. Most of my classmates did. I could go back to Japan, but I chose to go back to China, not only because there are a lot of opportunities, but I knew it's not going to be comfortable for me. It's, the key is going out of comfort zone. To make a difference, right? So make a difference is the slogan, it's a motto for Stanford. It's not making money, so this is very big. It's like I remember the professor in Stanford is like, you're the smartest and brightest people, that's why you got to Stanford. But in choosing a career and choosing going out of school, try to make a difference, not to make money, because making money for you guys are too easy. You got to aim for making a difference. So that's that really, you know, kind of drove me to go back to China to make a difference.
Got it. Very good. And then during that period of time while you were in China, you actually did start two companies, right?
Yes.
Did it go well?
Well, there's some ups and downs, right? I wouldn't say these are home runs. So the two companies, But it did learn something, and some of the investors made money, some of the investors lost money. I would say, so the first company was followed the concept of mass customization, all right? Which is, you know, my slogan for the first company is the shirt of Dell. So I was making shirts, and the shirts are customized, each person's size and design. But the idea is manufactured. So the front end user facing is customization. Everybody can customize their own shirt. And the back end is in China, leveraging China's manufacturing capability to mass produce these customized shirts and stuff using over internet. So that was the first. So the one liner of my first companies, the company name is called Beyond Tailors. Right?
Got it.
So Tailor can only do small scale customization, but Dell actually what did was mass production of customized products. So it's like, okay, if mass customization can happen, fashion should be the best area, because everybody looks different, everybody's size is different, everybody's personality is different. We should make customized fashion for each individual instead of selling off the rack, everybody wears the same clothes, right?
Got it. Wow, very good.
So the concept was good, but even today nobody can do it. That was 2005, 2006 when I started it. So almost 20 years passed. There are a lot of reasons I won't go too long, but basically the supply chain is very hard to achieve. Every single garment right now in the world is made by human hands, not by machine. So it's very hard to be like Dell, right? It's like assembling parts into a computer. Anyway, so after 1.5 years into that business, I quickly realized the bottlenecks to scale up, to be scalable. But I also encountered another business opportunity, which is at the same time, I would say on the manufacturing side, there are a lot of bottlenecks to do that. Also on the demand side, I realized most people don't need a customized shirt. They're happy with the off the rack shirt or anything, right? And so it's a very niche market, and this demand is not going to change. I'm not going to change people's mind. And intrinsically, people just don't need it, right? So I'm like, okay, why don't I just go for a main market, like mass market product, which I also learned a very successful company in the US called Victoria's Secret.
Yeah.
and I figure, oh, it's a symbol, right, of sexiness. And the business model is a very successful, right? Both the mail order online and also the, you know, physical shop. And the combination is very interesting. So I looked in the category of lingerie or blah bra in China. I realized there are 3,000 lingerie, I would say, underwear factories in China, but there's no single brand that's achieved the same level as Victoria's Secret achieved in the US. Because China was still back then the biggest manufacturing country in the world. So 80% of the bras sold in the world were manufactured in China. Like Apple computer, right? So the famous line that written on most of the Apple, like if you pick your MacBook, it says "Designed in California, assembled in China," right?
Got it.
And of course, the brand is from the US. So it's like, wow. And then I was very into branding. I was like, okay, China is already mature in terms of manufacturing, but what's lacking in China is branding.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I'm going to create a consumer brand. And what is branding? Right? And branding is basically identity. Branding. Brand is a name. Name is identity, right? So I was like, I'm going to create a brand that resonates with Chinese females, right? So that's why I created this brand called Lamiu. It's L-A-M-I-U. It gives the people a sense of, you know, kind of foreign taste. It's also sort of Japanese, sounds Japanese, sometimes sounds French. But the meaning of this brand is that la is like a music, right? It's do re mi fa sol la is a la, it's music. And mu is muses, right? So it's like we, every female, every single man, female, same, we all have our inner beauty, like the muses. They have a lot of talents inside of us, like the purpose of God that created us. We have a lot of purpose, a lot of talents that's sleeping inside of us. We don't even know.
Yeah.
And it's our job, our Lamiu, to use this brand, to use their product, to use our company, to wake up the sleeping talents inside of you. So you find your true self that's unique, that's different from others, that only exists in you, and you live out your created talent to be the best of you. So that's basically the brand concept and story. And our slogan is that sexiness is my attitude. So we changed the concept of, I would say changed. So we made the concept of sexiness much deeper. So Victoria's Secret sexiness is very obvious. It's physical sexiness, right? It's a sexy symbol of America. But that's a little bit too much for Asian culture, for Chinese culture, right? And also we realized we want what's really sexy is the way you live, is how you wake up your talents, you're chasing your dreams, you're making a difference, right? It's what's really sexy. We bring down to the mental level, that everybody can be sexy. So our advertising, our design is like the different body shape, different, you know, and everybody can be sexy. Very much like the Apple Air iPod commercials. Like life is colorful, you know, people are very different, but they're all on the same iPod. So iPod make them cool, and you can be different, and being different is cool. And what's cool, what's sexy is not the shape of your body, is your attitude.
Yeah, right.
That was the brand I created, and overnight became a phenomenon in China.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's, I would say, yeah. So again, choosing the hard path, right? Because creating a product is much easier, but creating a brand is very, very hard. But ultimately is resonation, is the identity, the association with this brand really made us stand out from other brands.
Now, Lou, is it still around? Is the brand still there?
All right, it's still there, but the company. So I, among other shareholder, decided to sell the business after 6 years in establishment, and now it's owned by a Chinese company.
It
looks very different. I would say it's a bit sad to see, you know, it become different, you know, because you know, as a founder, I feel like I infuse a soul into this brand. Right. But once the brand is sold, the visual, you know, we've called the visual merchandising, you know, started, you know, changing. Right. Because of course, the new owner has a different thought and infuse a different soul.
Yeah. Wow. Good. Hey, and even going back to your book as well, too, you go through all these different journeys. We were just talking before we started the interview. You have a daughter, 9 years old.
Yes.
You want to write the book for her. Talk to me about that.
Talk about my daughter? Talk about my family? Yeah,
about writing the book so that your daughter could read about your journey, understand your journey.
Yes. So I was thinking, you know, because I talk a lot about my grandpa in my book. I also talk a lot about my dad. But even when I'm writing the book, I realize I don't really know a lot about them, right? So I heard stories about them. They told me their life stories, but I don't see the entirety of their life stories. I feel there's still a lot of, it's like pieces of puzzles. I can see a little bit of my grandpa, my father, of course my mom, but for my grandpa, I know very little about him. I know only the period of time when I overlap with him, but I don't even know he's my grandfather's father, right? He never talked about it. So I just felt a lot of this is lost in the across generations, right? Which I think, you know, what is the family? What is the Dong family about, right? So I think the importance is the value. So what got passed through the families, generations in the Dong family is really our identity, really our value systems. I think that's very important. I need to let my daughter know where I came from. It's a very different world. She cannot even imagine, you know, this will be, you know, to her a movie, right? But I think that's important to just document it, you know? So my motivation to write about my life. And also even my father, my grandfather's life, a little bit of, so she can see where the entire family, why I become me, you know, the Lu Dong that she's looking at, right?
And even your faith journey. I mean, a lot of times you really didn't start talking about your faith journey to the end. Talk to me about the reason behind all that.
Okay. I really admire this person, Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
Yes, right. He's I watch a lot of these videos. I haven't met him in person, but I read his books. I watch a lot of his videos. He talked a lot about servant leadership. I even took a servant leadership training course.
Yeah.
With Carl, but basically the contents largely from or inspired by Cate Blanchett. I saw his style is very flexible. So there are times when he talks to Christians, like 100% Christian believers, throughout the content, he's quoting, you know, Bible verses. He's very, very specific about Bible. But then at times when he talks to college students or, you know, just like a mix maybe of a believer, non-believer, he could do a one-hour speech without mentioning a word of God or Bible, quoting Bible verses. When I see this, it's like, and also in Japan, there's only 1% of Christians, right? So yeah. I was thinking, I want to write a book so everybody can read it, they don't just turn it off. They don't get turned off by hearing the word of God or Bible. They're just like, oh, don't talk about Bible. Don't talk about Bible. There are a lot of people, they have a lot of prejudice about Christianity from whatever experience they had in the past. So I don't want to turn them off initially from the beginning of the book. So that's why only toward the end of the book, I start naturally bring the concept of God. That's one reason. And the other reason is this is true. I didn't know God when I was doing, you know, like describing, you know, the chapters when I grew up in China. I didn't know God. I grew up in a communist country. I came to Japan, you know, all this, you know, I went to Goldman, I went to Stanford. All this time, I didn't know God. I thought I was doing this by myself. This book is more like, I would say, a real-time documentary of how I lived my life back then, right? But only realize in the end, when I also, of course, when I first met God, I got baptized, I became a Christian in 2007. I would say the level of experience of God was very different from when I really suffered. The past chapter, that's why in the last chapter, my current company is largely about COVID, that I realized, I reflect my life, why all these terrible things happened to me? What did I do wrong? Why do I have to be a good person? Why do I have to work so hard? All this why came to me. Then only in the past 4 years, I think I reached a new level of my understanding of God or His way.
Yeah.
For all these years, God is always there. It's just that I didn't realize He was there. I just didn't realize He led me through. He gave me life. He walked me. Of course, I have free will. But in whichever decision I make, He was always walking along me and guiding me and ultimately led me here, you know, to my current state of myself. So I think also it's very natural. So I want to give the readers the natural development of myself. Like, that's why I think the subtitle is called A Journey from Personal Survival and Success, right, to Servant Leadership. So I would say, I think I can see myself mature during the process of my life only in the last chapter, like most recently, even though I'm 51 years old, I still feel like I'm 4 years old in terms of living the latest state of Christianity.
And Louis, it reminds me of a story. I was just studying Elijah and preaching on Elijah. Is he's in Cherith, and God tells him, I want you to go to Zarephath. I want you to walk 100 miles to the home of to the birthplace of Queen Jezebel. And there he encounters a woman, a widow, who's picking up sticks. And she says, hey, look, if you need any food, I have no food. I'm picking up sticks. I have a little oil. I have a little flour. I'm going to put some water and I'm going to make some bread. And then my son and I are going to eat it and die. And Elijah is probably wondering, Lord, you made me walk 100 miles. And for this, are you serious? God knows where you are. God knows where you need to go. And God knows what you need. But sometimes what we think we need is not what He says that we need. And we just have to be okay with it and continue to trust and follow Him.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you for summarizing that.
But that is the hard part though, right? I mean, Lou, is what does it mean?
I'm still figuring out.
Yeah, right? Look, I say this is I have a friend, our friend Sharon, right after Thanksgiving in the U.S., and this was a couple years ago, she was diagnosed with cancer. All her life, Lou, she had wanted to retire early. And on the day she retired, she was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And she went through for about a year and a half, 2 years, and then she got a prognosis that she wasn't going to live. And on the Sunday before she died, I sat there with her. And she says to me, Tommy, why did God allow this to happen? I am so angry. All my life I worked and my goal was just to retire early. And now I'm dying. How do you trust God? How do you not be angry at him? And so we had a long conversation. Sometimes we don't know. What we think we should be doing, what we think we want, may not be what God wants. What does it mean to trust them?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So I'm glad my parents gave me this name, right? Dong Lu in the Chinese means understanding the way, right? And I really like this name. I think a lot of people said, oh, based on your name, you should be a tour guide. and now when I think about it, I think I am a tour guide. I think my role to the people around me is a tour guide to the kingdom of God.
Yeah, yeah.
A tour guide of life, a tour guide of career, a tour guide of a guide. I want to be the guide. So this book is not about me. Again, it's like I want to be the sign of the road. Yeah. So then when people see me, they can see that I'm pointing to God.
Yeah.
That's why I want to, so the season two, if I write season two, it's like how I really walk this way is, it's not my way. It's not the way I want it is what God wants. And it's not always every turn, right? Or ups and downs, I understand at the moment, right? But is his way. I just need to learn how to walk the narrow path, right? Not the easy path, and still be steadfast and focused, right?
Hearing your story reminds me again of Elijah as well, too, what we were talking about. If you look at Hebrews 11, Lou, there is no mention of Elijah. The guy who was lifted by God and who never died, there's no mention about Hebrew in Hebrews when he was going through all the faith heroes. The only mention of anything about Elijah was that the dead comes to life, clearly referencing the how he brought the widow's son from death. And at the end of 1 Kings chapter 17, the widow upon Elijah saving the widow's son says to him, clearly, you are a man of God. She never said, clearly, you're a strong man. Clearly, you're a powerful man. But clearly, you are a man of God. Always giving credit to God. So thank you for that lesson that you taught us here today.
Thank you, Tommy, for, bringing up so many stories out of me. You're a very good listener. You're good, you're very good at asking questions.
Yeah.
And well, you're very good at quoting Bibles, Thank you. Yeah.
Lou, the one thing I noticed that you're really good at, even as I read your book, you do a good job of reflecting and understanding how the story shaped who you are. And even for those who are listening to it, one of the things I tell younger people all the time is they always say, I want to know what God wants me to do. I want to know what God wants me to do. I'm passionate about God. I said, sometimes you have to reflect upon what God has been doing in your life and the lessons that he's taught you in order to truly know what the next step is. And you have done a very, very good job with that.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, again, it's not me. I think from a childhood, right, I was encouraged by my grandpa. Always ask why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything around you, don't take it granted. Just always questioning. I think that's a very important quality as an entrepreneur. And also, very important in my Christian, faith too.
Yeah.
Always ask it why and look for the answers. The ultimate answer is in the Bible. It's the instruction for universe and human race. if I don't have any questions, all the answers is in the Bible. It's up to me to find it, right?
Hey, as we wrap up, let me end with one final but fun question for you. With your app, what is the one restaurant that is in the most demand that everybody that has the most hits?
Sure. Yes. So there's this restaurant in Shinjuku. If you know Shinjuku, it's probably the Times Square, of Tokyo. It's a yakiniku restaurant called Rokkasen. Yakiniku means a Japanese, I would say, beef barbecue. Right, so you grill, so all wagyu, Yeah, Wagyu, all you can eat, any style. You can do grill, you can do sukiyaki, you can do shabu shabu.
Wow.
All Wagyu. It's very popular. And it's just hands down. Like at one moment, I think 50% of our entire revenue is generated by this one restaurant.
Seriously? So
yes. And still, it's so popular. It's so popular.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Next time I come to Tokyo, I would like to try this restaurant. Well, no, at the same time, I have no taste buds. I have no saliva. So that's a whole different thing. But I would like to try one day.
Sure, sure. Please. But my opinion, just to be honest, I think there are at least 1,000 restaurants in Tokyo that has equivalent quality of this Rokkasen. What's really interesting is online. The online traffic really skew. It's not 80-20 rule. It's like the 1 and 99 rule.
Yeah.
Like 99% of the traffic goes to the 1% of whatever, you know, whether it's an influencer, whether it's YouTuber. It's even though, like I said, there's like 1,000 or even 10,000 restaurants, they're as good as this one restaurant. But somehow all the traffic just go to this one.
Yeah.
Our job is to evenly distribute the traffic to a lot of the unknown restaurants.
Yeah. It's like if you come to visit me in Chicago, right, and we go to Chinatown, there are some restaurants that are so crowded and so packed. In my head, I'm sitting there, why are you going to this restaurant? There's this other restaurant down the line. It doesn't look very nice, but it has so much better food.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's a snowball effect, right? So more people go in there. They read more reviews, then more traffic, more influencers go there. They got more traffic. So it's amplifying effect.
Yeah.
But, so the winner takes all on internet, right? Whereas in the real world, it's just really, really a lot of good restaurants, and some even better than this one I mentioned. But hey, that's why we're here. We're trying to, you know, help you discover the unknown part of Tokyo, and always be in a good quality, and you're secured with the table, you know. So that's I think that's a value creation between the restaurant side and also the tourist side. Yeah.
Well, we talked a lot. And so thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, Lou.
Thank you. Thank you, Tommy. I am always amazed by your story too. You're such inspiration to me. Thank you. And looking forward to seeing you in person again.
Yeah. We'll talk soon.